Someone just asked me if I was on the planning committee. And in great Groucho Marx fashion, I simply answered no, because if I had been, I don't think I would have invited me to give these theme talks. You know, I can't wait to get here every morning, which is pretty interesting. I don't know if it's nervous energy or just excitement or a mix of them all. My mother thought I had a problem, that I had the heebie-jeebies and I'd never sit still. I was one of those kids, you know, always swinging a golf club or a bat in the house on a rainy day. And I smashed a couple of tables and chipped the stove and in the kitchen and so forth. Will you stop? My mother could say. She had this great, will you stop? Anyway, I can't wait to get here every day. It's very stimulating for me, and it's great. All the sacred encounters I've had this week with different people have been wonderful. I think my favorite is a young adult whom I hadn't seen in over 10 years said that she was anticipating this, you know, this event and seeing me and so forth, but she was worried that there'd be this old guy stooped over with a cane, you know, going like this. So she was quite relieved when that wasn't the case. And I've also heard someone wants to dye my hair. I don't know about that. So a little less controversy today, but a Boston hat, but not Red Sox, because I know Red Sox gets a different reaction. It's Bruins, so people can live with the Bruins better than the Red Sox. You have to understand, though, you know, being from Boston originally, I left and spent 35 years away and a lot of it in Pittsburgh, but there was a book in 1986, and anyone who knows this history, it was called The Curse of the Bambino, 1986. Dan Shaughnessy, a good sports writer, he's kind of a brat, actually. I've learned to not like him so well, but then I thought he was really witty and clever, and he is. But those were the years where we hadn't had a World Series since 1918, and right after we sold Babe Ruth, who could sell Babe Ruth? The Red Sox did it. Pirates might, yeah. So anyway, in 1986, after, you know, in 67 we were close, in 75 we were close, in 86 the ball went through Bill Buckner's legs and we lost the Mets. So he wrote this book, The Curse of the Bambino. You know, Babe Ruth was the Bambino. And once we sold him, we've been cursed. Well, anyway, the curse has been lifted. And Shaughnessy's, you know, the interest in Shaughnessy's gone way down because it was fun having this curse, right? You know, New England, Puritan theology, all of that kind of played in, you know, yeah, we really are cursed. So we get rolling. So these talkbacks are good, they're interesting. People raised issues around social justice yesterday about accessibility. And are you going to raise that issue? I won't speak to that directly, but it's a great social justice issue, accessibility in our churches, in the wider community, and so forth. A lot of talk about environmental issues and our eating patterns, you know, food use and so forth. So lots of great stuff is emerging. But what I'm going to do right now is just clean up from yesterday, as I always try to do, one or two things I hadn't said, and then move into today's topic. A little bit of a minefield, actually, I think, today's topic. But, you know, that's what we do. We go into minefields and try to navigate. So today's topic is around ethnicity, race, class, that kind of thing, and how we deal with that in our social analysis as we're trying to decide how to do social justice. But cleaning up yesterday. So we talked yesterday about democracy and government and corporations over here, individuals here, and civil society in the middle. And the weaker civil society is, then the less democracy we have. Civil society being strong with lots of groups, as James Luther Adams talks about, voluntary associations, advocating for the common good, essential to democracy. And as those weaken, democracy is weakened. So then at the talkback, we mentioned different kinds of rights. And I think I'm right about this. No one challenged me. I think I'm right about this. So the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which I think through the United Nations came out in the late 40s, I think I'm right, if anyone remembers, has two dimensions to it, political and economic rights, okay, and a whole series of specifics about what makes a political right. And as far as I'm aware, I could be wrong, the United States signed on to the political rights part, but not the economic, ever. Now, a lot of nations did sign on to both. And so, therefore, you know, political rights, freedom of speech, movement, and so forth. I think we're pretty good at that. Pretty good. Economic rights, we've never signed on. And as far as I can tell in our society, we don't have them. Do we have a right to a home or education? Or we don't have rights like that, right? So forth. Food, education. Public education, yeah. Up until higher grades, right? Through high school, we do, yeah. So we don't really have a lot of economic rights, housing, jobs, right to a job, and all that kind of stuff. Or even, as we said about Nixon yesterday, right to a guaranteed income. We don't, you know. We have a safety net, you know, kind of TANF. It's not welfare anymore, but it's eroding and so forth, you know. So economic rights, a big, big issue that we don't have. Now, so I shared with the group yesterday and wanted to share with you this amazing statement by our Universalist brethren, forebears, in 1917 in Worcester, Massachusetts. Worcester, Massachusetts. Looks like Worcester, but we say Worcester. 1917, our Universalist forebears said this at an annual conference. We, and I'm quoting, "We brand as infamous the practice of subordinating human interests to business interests. Democracy, in order to be complete, must be economic and social as well as political. We therefore declare for the democratization of industry and of land. Some form of social insurance should gradually replace the present individualistic and inadequate methods of charitable relief. In short, they declared, we must establish an economic order which shall give to every human being an equal share in the common gifts of God, and in addition to all she or he shall earn by her or his own labor." 1917, Universalist, Worcester, Massachusetts. Lastly, cleaning up, we talked about Dr. King yesterday, this amazing, what Cornel West calls organic intellectual, an amazing organic intellectual, basically meaning this brilliant fellow went to BU, got his PhD, wrote about Henry Nelson Wyman, a great Unitarian, by the way, compared his theology of God with Tillich, I think, maybe. So brilliant on that level. He could have been a good scholar, but he chose to be a minister and do a lot of community organizing and he did that brilliantly, too, with a lot of other people. He was hardly alone, Dr. King. But we remember a lot about Dr. King up until 1965. We talked yesterday about civil rights legislation. We talked about in 1964, 65, voting rights. Huge, huge pieces of legislation around rights, particularly for disenfranchised people, mostly African American. But huge, huge. And we remember the speech, 1963, I Have a Dream. Phenomenal speech, one of the greatest in our country's history, no question. But less people know about the last 3 years of his life, where against protests from many of his friends and colleagues, he opposed the Vietnam War, saw this whole war machine. I think maybe by 67 he came out against that. A lot of his friends said, mistake, don't do it. You'll take the focus off. But he saw this system, this war system, and he opposed it and lost a lot of support for that. In 1968, King realized that it was the capitalist system that was at the base of all these isms, racism and otherwise, and he had to take it head on. And so he was organizing a poor people's march, if you remember, in 1968 when he was gunned down. So what's the relationship between his assassination and that moment in which he took on the capitalist economic system and realized that economy was at the fundamental base of the lack of democracy? So that part of King's life isn't often remembered very well. Okay, so we're back. Now we're here. Now it's Thursday. We're back to Thursday, so here we are, Thursday's topic. So I had the incredible privilege of being asked by one of my best friends and colleagues in our UU movement, Reverend Don Robinson, Washington, D.C. Don started 20 years ago, a little bit more, a place called Beacon House. Beacon House. It's a ministry to with people in a very challenged area of Washington, D.C., northeast section of Washington, D.C., what Don refers to as a killing zone or a sacrifice zone, where lots of drug trade murders happen and so forth. There's Don right in the midst of that, and he founded a place called Beacon House, mostly to do outreach with children and youth and provide programming, after-school kind of stuff, all through the summer. It's a 12-month program. And this guy, who's 75 years old, is really 50, and he's got incredible energy and probably services 500 to 600 children, youth, a year on his programming. All sorts of stuff going on. And yet he's a well-kept secret in our movement. Well, Don had the privilege of being asked to give this big speech to the ministers group just before General Assembly this year. It's called the Berry Street Lecture. I've referred to Fred Muir, who did it in 2012. And anyway, Don was asked to do the Berry Street Lecture. And this is a great honor to be recognized to do this. And so he called me up one day and he said, "Brother Art, I want you to respond to my speech." You know, so there's this lecture, which is 50 minutes or so, and then the respondent gets 15 or 20. And he wanted me to be, and Don and I are kind of partners in a lot of way. Great brother, and we share a social vision. So it was a privilege for me to be asked to respond to this Unitarian Universalist giant in our movement, whom I think people need to know more about, and about the Beacon House and what it does. Don's always saying, "Lord, have mercy, Art, what I could do if I had more resources. I could create more programs. I could save more children." And he says that all the time. "Art, we saved some children today, but if I had more resources, I could save more, because kids are dying all the time." So what do I say in response to this giant, to this wonderful ministry and so forth? So I focused on two areas, and I tried to stay close to his speech. In other words, what in his speech touched off something in me that I want to raise up and bring to the next level if the people, the 500 ministers there, didn't hear it. This is what I heard. I said, "You heard something else maybe." And one was the importance of social location in our ministry, in our congregations. Where are we located? Our UU. Where is our UU presence, our social location? So you know that I started in the UU world in 19, Melanie reminded me it was 1990 we showed up at Allegheny. 91 they asked me to become director of social advocacy and do neighborhood outreach. I found out shortly after arriving, at Allegheny, that was struggling, by the way. Allegheny was struggling big time. There weren't many people left, and they were talking about maybe we have to close. So, Art, maybe you can work for 2 years. We have enough money to give you, and then if we die, we die, but we'll make a contribution. I found out shortly after being there that in the 60s, sometime in the 1960s, when First Unitarian Church in Pittsburgh did this very good thing, helped spin off three new churches in the suburbs, East Suburban, North, and South, and we have people from each of those congregations now. Good congregations, good idea. I'm glad it happened. But the downside of it was that the UUA, our association, asked a prominent UU minister to go to Allegheny, which is in a north side of the city and struggling, to close. And the message was, if you're a good Unitarian Universalist, you'll close, because you're dying anyway, and you'll go to the north, east, and south and feed that new movement. And because there were a dozen or so stubborn Unitarian Universalists, no, then probably there were more. There were probably 25 or 30 or so. They didn't close. They waited for the reinforcements to show up. And they eventually did. And Reverend Jesse Cavalier, another UU giant, helped keep that place alive until the reinforcements came in the 80s and 90s. But I wonder where else that happened across our movement, because we lost a lot of urban churches because the demographics are changing. That's not where, you know, we are anymore, and we need to kind of move on. Now, I want to be very clear about this. This is not a subtle critique of suburban UU churches. I serve one now up in Massachusetts. But it's a critique of where is our UU presence in these sacrifice zones, these killing zones, as more and more churches have closed, and we let them close somehow. So social location. This is what it, so Don is in this social location where he sees a certain social reality very powerfully. It's a killing zone in Washington, D.C., where he is, and he sees kids dying all the time. So where are we located? Social location matters because when we talk about justice, now this question got raised a couple times. So what is justice? So we tried to define it, but it always is contextual. Justice in every context is going to look a little bit different. So the question we raise is, when you say, well, what is social justice? We don't want to answer that in the abstract. We want to say, how does it look in the city of Pittsburgh? How does it look in North Hills? How does it look in Cleveland? You know, the social context. What is social justice? And whose lens are we looking at? Through whose eyes? We all have different ways of looking at reality. And depending upon our social location, socioeconomically, racially, by ethnicity, suburban, urban, rural, so forth and so on, we see different issues. Because I think there actually are sacrifice zones everywhere, not just in the city, in the rural and suburban areas. There are places where things aren't going well, where people are struggling and suffering. But nevertheless, we define social justice in a context, and we look through a certain lens, and every perspective sees something a bit different. Now, I learned this from liberation theology. I would say in the 20th century, or at least the second half of the 20th century, and if you read UU theology works, this will kind of go back and forth. There are two, I think, major theological developments that are significant for UUs, but for probably most, at least in the sort of Christian world, Christian humanist, UU Quaker world. One is liberation theology, which I've raised up, and I will one more time today. The other is a thing called process theology, which is a very interesting development. Henry Nelson Wyman, one of our people, actually is at the root of that in the earlier part of the 20th century. But and a lot of UUs really think process theology is a really good way to understand what's real and so forth. But I'm a liberation theology guy. That's what I've learned so much from. And liberation theology, I've mentioned this idea of institutional violence, structural injustice. The other insight that liberation theology gave us as it emerged from Latin America in the late 60s, early 70s, is a thing called, sorry for the big word, but we can break it down if need be, the epistemological privilege of the poor. So that word epistemology, you know, how do we understand? How do we know? Again, how do we see social reality? How do we understand? The Latin American theologians said, in their context, they're asking the poor to tell us about social reality. We're giving them the privilege of sharing their experience, and we're going to then do theological reflection and eventually action on that based on this lens that the disenfranchised, the oppressed, the poor are giving us. So they have an epistemological privilege. It came out, and you may have heard this one, the preferential option for the poor. The other way of saying that. And so it's their lens, their experience, that we're doing our theology from. Now, this brings up one of my props that I've delayed until today. My ash can. I know that got lost in this, right? My ash can. So anyway, on the front of this, it says ash can theology. Ash can theology. So where did this all come from? Little anecdote. So I'm in the seminary, 1978. I finished my MDiv, Master of Divinity, and, you know, I'm decent at theology, and they recognize that. So I want to do one more year of theology, and they and my superiors say, fine, go for it. And so I apply to different schools, and I get into Yale Divinity School and Union Theological Seminary. So I have to make a choice. And Yale had a little bit of money they were going to throw at me. Union didn't. And I was going for another theology degree in STM, Master in Sacred Theology. So I go to my superior and I say, Mark, you decide. I can't decide. You know, Yale, I get in. Union, Yale's given me a little bit of money maybe. And Mark said, nope, it's your decision, Art. I will not decide for you. You have to decide. So I think about it. Yale, Union. And I say, and I go back and I say, Union. I want to go to Union Theology in New York City, not Yale in New Haven. So I go into Mark and I say, I made a decision, Mark. I'm going to Yale, Union. And no answer. He's sitting there pondering. Doesn't say anything. And it's getting uncomfortable, really uncomfortable. And I'm thinking, he's not happy. So all of a sudden he stands up and he starts walking around the room. Mark is a little eccentric, a wonderful guy, but a little eccentric. So he starts walking around the room like in a Shakespearean kind of, and he starts talking to no one that I know. It's like this soliloquy is just going off, you know, Mark's going off. And he's walking around in the room. And I'm squirming. And he starts talking to this guy, and he says, when I think of Yale Divinity School, New Haven, Connecticut, he said, I think of contemplation and the life of study and mysticism and high, lofty thinking. And when I think of Union Seminary in New York City, I think of bums on the street and trash cans and liturgies on the stairwells. And I said, oh, crap. Then it's over, the soliloquy, and he sits down and he starts typing on an old typewriter. And he gives me the letter. And it's to our superior, his and mine, saying, give Art McDonald permission to go to Union Theological Seminary in New York City. So that was Mark, you know, he just got it out of his system and we moved on. He wasn't happy, and he saw these as two different realities, which probably they are, and I think he nailed it pretty well. Because Union Theological Seminary has always, at least in my knowledge, had both schools have had theological giants. But this is a place that has a reputation. You know, more likely if you go to Yale Divinity, you'll get a little more philosophy. At Union, you'll get sociology and, you know, social interaction and a little Marxism and so forth. And you'll get more critique of society. So, bums in the street, trash cans. So from that time on, I own this designation, Ashcan Theologian. Now, so why that's important, if it's not already obvious, is that's the lens I'm using. Outside of Union Theological Seminary, out in the street, what the social reality of that lens, okay? I learned it in Latin America, and now I'm learning it in New York City. And you see something different outside Union Theological Seminary than you do from Yale Divinity. Both wonderful schools, and reasons to go to either. But different social realities outside the window. So social location, how you see social reality, then helps you determine what you think is social justice. When you do your theological reflection, you put your values to work here, and then ultimately you do action based on what you see, social analysis, your theological reflection, your values, then you put together action strategies. And they're a little bit different in New York City than in New Haven. And you can take that anywhere you want. So that was the first thing I said in reaction to Don's wonderful Berry Street lecture, the importance of social location. And I, toward the end of that part, part one, social location, and I had shared the story about Allegheny being asked to close and watched other churches close in those urban areas. And I just said to the group, so where are we, you use? Where are we located It does matter. Or who are we connecting with if we're not located in one of these sacrifice zones? Now, the second thing I said about Don's wonderful speech has to do with this whole question of, as you're doing social analysis and ultimately theological reflection and then action, you need tools. You need social tools, and you need ideas and theories and experiences so that you can understand social reality. Bill Jones, a wonderful UU philosopher and theologian who died recently, who wrote so much about anti-racism strategies, but many other things, including liberation theology, Bill always said, you know, he used this medical analogy. If you're going to prescribe something, you know, some medicine, you need to analyze what the problem is, because you don't want to give the wrong pill, you know, if you don't know what you're dealing with. So you try best as you can as a doctor to analyze what the problem is. Then, oh, that pill works for this issue. Same with social analysis. You've got to make sure you're understanding what's going on before you implement a strategy to attack it. So wonderful insight on Bill's part. Now, so I said at this speech, in the last 20, 25 years, Unitarian Universalism, through our UUA, has done wonderful work, especially consciousness-raising, education around anti-racism, our Journey to Wholeness program, LGBT awareness, and now increasingly multiculturalism and so forth. So we've done a lot of good education, a lot of good analyzing from all those lenses, creating much more awareness about how racism works, how multiculturalism works, you know, the oppression experienced by gay, lesbian, transgender, bisexual people and so forth. We should be proud of that. Some really good programming and work and so forth. Now, I'm not always sure that we've always come up with action programs to match this great awareness, this great education. We have a lot of great ideas and understandings. I'm not always sure we're as strong on action programs, though I know there are examples here and there and so forth, but I think that's always the challenge. So we have these insights. What are we doing with them? You know, how are we actually making a difference? And there's a really good dialogue. I didn't put it in my bibliography. It was a mistake. But you can get it from the UUA bookstore, a book called Soul Work, Anti-Racist Theologies and Dialogue. And about 30 UUs participated in this process. I know Brother Mel was in this process and is quoted here, but many others. And so it was published in 2003, Soul Work. I think it's a really good read, chewing over all these issues, social analysis, and how it all works. So, and in this time, you know, the work that we've done on racism, structural racism, our anti-racism work is so important. In this time, in this last days, you know, this whole terrible, tragic case of Trayvon Martin, that you, even if it's SI, you've probably seen little news, that this fellow who shot him was acquitted, and the controversy around that, this clearly isn't dying. I mean, people are going to be looking at this and reworking it and saying, how can this happen? A young teenager was shot. You know, what role did race play? Come on, how is this possible? And so forth. So it's a terrible, terrible moment, and it makes us look at this whole question again. Was he shot because he was African-American young person? I mean, is that really the explanation? Maybe a little more to it, but is that really how it all happened? So it's a terrible moment. So I was speaking with Mel yesterday about this, and, you know, part of our anti-racism work is, of course, that African-Americans need white allies, you know, working in coalitions to overcome all these horrible effects of racism. And so Mel reminded me that I'm one of the white allies, and I said, no, I am not white. I said to Mel, I am not white. I have never been white. And you have to understand where that's coming from. But one of my favorite books of all time is a book that actually I preached on it once and brought a member. It was a church growth strategy, actually. I brought a member into the congregation with this sermon. And the book is entitled How the Irish Became White. It's a phenomenal read, and there's a lot of literature on this, how the Irish became white. We weren't always white, nor were Italians, and so forth and so on. So, and I went to a workshop in Pittsburgh once with a great guy named Ron Chisholm. Ron Chisholm, an African-American organizer from, I think, New Orleans. And he forced us to go through this exercise, which was really interesting. So Ron says at one point in the workshop, and it's an anti-racism workshop, and Ron's doing it, and you know, this powerful African-American guy, and he said, all right, I've got, this is what you have to do. He said, you have to break it into little groups, and you have to talk about your culture, your ethnicity. You got to do this. He said, you know, this isn't going to be easy for all you white people. He said, because, you know, in my culture, it's easy to talk about culture. You know, we can talk about the black spirituals, you know, blues, jazz. We can talk about food. There's all sorts of stuff we can talk about that's part of our culture. You guys have to do the same. So most of us there were white, and we broke down. And I sat with a good buddy, Molly Rush from Pittsburgh, whom I worked with for years, a wonderful activist. And so Molly and I right away, it was easy, because Molly and I both have a very deep sense of being Irish. And so we started talking about that, and we came up with this song, this melancholic song about Ireland that we were going to say. Oh, and Ron said, then you have to come back and share it, a poem, a song. And so Molly and I sang this song about Ireland. It was easy. She said, oh, my dad sang that every day. Yeah. And I said, I grew up with Joe Feeney from Lawrence Welk singing this song. Yeah, it was easy. So Molly and I, it was 50% of the people there, the white people there, blank. They had nothing to say. I don't know what my culture is. My ancestors came on the original ships. I don't know. I'm American. So Ron, you know, he didn't want to let go of that, and he kept pushing. You've got to work on this. What is your ethnicity and culture? Great exercise. Easy for some of us, impossible for others. So something for you to think about, you know. So I raise that because one of our theologians, who I think is really an interesting woman, and you had her here 3 years ago, Tandeka, really interesting woman on this whole issue of race, class, ethnicity, and so forth. She's written a book. It's in my bibliography, which, whether you agree with it or not, and it caused a lot of stirring, a lot of controversy, but it's an interesting read. She talked about how the ethnicities, the Italians, the Irish, as they came to this country, they realized and in some ways were pressured to become white by the white Anglo-Saxon establishment so that they could separate it out from African Americans, people of African descent. Otherwise, they'd always be identified with them as they were in the early going. You know, there's a lot of intermarriage between African Americans and Irish. But that, you know, eventually they became white and they separated out. You know, this horrible thing that happened. So Tandeka talks about that a lot. And like Ron Chisholm, I think, encourages us to get in touch with our ethnicity, you know, our real roots, our cultures, and this white thing that was a social construct that isn't. What's white? It's nothing. It's just. But as Mel reminds me, and will always, and he should, in this country, it is something. It is something. That's part of the dysfunction of our culture in America, that white is something, as black is something, and there's this historical division. And so for strategic reasons only, I say, you have to be white, you know, to be an ally, okay, in this fight against racism. But at the same time, you know, be bilingual and get in touch with your culture and ethnicity, which has nothing to do with white. And I rest my case. Anyway, so the other thing so Tandeka, and it's way too complicated to try to do here, but what she tries to do is to put this whole question of racism in the context of class and economic inequality and so forth. And basically what she's saying is not that there isn't racism or that we need to get beyond anti-racism strategy, but we have to, in our social analysis, thank you, Bill Jones, we have to see how class and race and gender intersect to explain social reality, how they intersect as various oppressions. But This class issue is something that we as UUs, but not only us, this whole country has had a hard time getting a hold of or talking about. Class makes us very uncomfortable. And what do you mean? Anyone can make it up the ladder and so forth. So we haven't done a good job on class. And I think it's fair to say, UU, we've talked around it, we've danced around it, but we don't really analyze class or how it intersects with the other isms. Some years ago at Allegheny, in the early going actually, a UU person from outside came in, you know, to give us some advice, and we went to lunch afterwards, I did with this person, and the person said to me, by the way, Art, that bag lady in the back of the church at Sunday service, does she come regularly? And I said, that bag lady's been a member of the church for 50 years. She raised her kids in this church. What exactly do you mean, bag lady? More recently, up in Massachusetts, one of our churches closed in an urban working-class neighborhood in Saugus, Massachusetts, Universalist church with a great history. And a UUA official said to me, who wasn't really lamenting it closed, said, you know, Art, UU doesn't work very well in working-class areas. So, you know, Saugus was going to die. It was hard for me to hear. So how does this class stuff work? Thandeka, and I have some bibliography there, and the World Magazine has published some great stuff on what she says and dialogues about class and race and how they intersect and how to understand class. So I'd say read that stuff. It's real, even if you disagree, which you might, read it. It's rich and it's insightful, and it shows how complex oppression can be, how complex it is, and the various ways in which there are intersections. I learned about class early on. You know, yesterday I blamed that on Nietzsche, that little snore. I figured, yeah, I would be snoring if someone cited Nietzsche too. So I avoided Nietzsche today. And right on schedule at 10:10, I get a snore. What is this? Maybe these should be 30-minute talks, not 40. Huh? Oh, I don't blame you. It was a long night. So, as I was saying before, I was so... So I learned about class early on in my dad's grocery store. I grew up in a grocery store. You know this fellow... Robert Fulghum has this book, Everything I Needed to Know I Learned in Kindergarten. Well, if I wrote the book, it would be the grocery store. You know? And so in the grocery store, I watched, I don't know why I was aware of this, but I watched my dad who flunked Greek, he said. He went to Boston Latin School, this great old school, and he flunked Greek. So he dropped out of school in the 10th grade, went to work for his father, and then opened his own grocery store later, and that's where I grew up, all my siblings and I. We grew up in the grocery store. So my dad always aspired up. I mean, he always, you know, when doctors and lawyers, and we had some, would come into the market in Jamaica Plain, part of Boston, which was an interesting part of Boston. You know, one side of Center Street was all working class, one side was all professional. So when professionals would come in, doctors and lawyers, my dad would perk up. I could see it. And he'd pay special attention to those folks. Dr. Carroll and Dr. Solomon and blah, blah, blah. And I watched this happen. And then when ordinary slobs like the rest of us came in, my dad would always be pleasant. My dad was a good guy, but he wouldn't perk up in the same way. And I watched that go on over the years. And I started the seeds of watching how class works. And, you know, my dad would just pay special attention. And he thought these were different kind of people. So I saw class early on, and it bothered me. You know, what does this mean? And probably even I developed a little bit of an edge on this issue. You know, when Dr. Carroll came in and said, I'm not going to wait on him. My dad's going to take care of that. But there was this sensibility there early on. So I think the most powerful experience I've had in ministry now, these many years later, around how to do social analysis and how to diagnose a social problem was certainly at Allegheny. Allegheny's located in a very, to me, very interesting area because there's a lot of race, ethnicity, class stuff going on around Allegheny. There's a lot of poverty a few blocks away from the church, and there's a lot of wealth around the church. And it's a killing zone. Young people, community activists, and of course all these tenants, almost all of them American women, almost all who at least came to the meeting. And so we started strategizing what to do about this. Two women, I had known them already a little, but now I really got to know them well. And they would come to our church once in a while, but and use the building a lot for meetings and so forth. So I used to go then to the meetings just of the tenants group, and often I was the only person that looked like this there with 8 to 10 or 12, mostly African-American women. And I said it one day to the leader, this woman, Ronell. I said, geez, sometimes I feel uncomfortable, like I shouldn't be here, Ronell. And Ronell said, oh, Art, you're one of us. You stay. You've got your ghetto card. You've earned it, she said. And then the next meeting, so I said, now I'm comfortable. It's okay for me to show up here, and these women don't think I'm a goofball and I shouldn't be here. The next meeting, after it was over, Ronell comes over to me, and she said, Art, I have to tell you something funny. I was talking to my husband about these meetings, and he said, well, who was there? And I named all the people, and then I said, you. And he said, Art McDonald? Who's that guy? And she tried to describe me, and oh, he said, oh, is that the little white guy with the afro? That's right. So even he was all right with it. So one night, when things weren't looking great, we were sitting around, and again, these same women and myself, and one of the younger black women said, you know, this is a really hard struggle, and it's clear those people want us out because we're black. And an older black woman who had been in the neighborhood much, much longer and knew the neighborhood better and kind of understood what was going on, she said, well, she said, yeah, that's part of it, she said, but the real reason they want us out is because we're poor. We're poor. And I said, wow, that was phenomenal to hear this woman, this wise, saged woman, understanding the dynamics. And you know, at that time, there was a real estate agent. I don't know if he's still there. I don't even want to know. But there was a real estate agent that that was in that neighborhood trying to raise prices, you know, in a section called the Mexican War. And he was determined, particularly, to get outsiders who didn't really know the north side of Pittsburgh to pay a high price. And you could see these prices going up. Is really, talk about misuse of power. Catherine, wherever Catherine might be, talked about evil. Where does he, you know, Luther Adams talks about a lot of evil is misuse of power. Power used for evil purposes, for dominating purposes. So that was an amazing insight to me, this intersection of gender, race, and class in this neighborhood, in this amazing neighborhood, which I loved. And it was just such... And so anyway, to bring it to an end, we did have some success, fortunately, because we had a great lawyer and these wonderful tenants who just were determined. We were able to actually get the government to extend the Section 8 parts, and then they started working on maybe ownership and so forth. So it was a nice little victory. Sometimes you have to celebrate these victories. They weren't evicted. They extended Section 8, and then they started working on actually owning the houses as time went on. And I was told by Uncle Andy that he thinks that some of these places are owned now by the former tenants, which is a great victory, actually. So I realized, and then the last experience of this intersection is, I know there was a lot of dialogue in many places, but certainly in Pittsburgh, around racism. And so we would come together often with African-American pastors and some of us white allies and talk about race and race. And at one point in time, the pastors said to me and others, you know, we're tired of talking about this race stuff. We've told you everything we know and how we experience it, and we're not coming to these meetings anymore. Not because we don't like you and we need allies. What we need is jobs, housing, you know, better education, better schools. And when you're ready to join us in this march for housing, schools, education, jobs, and so forth, then this is really the best kind of anti-racism work you could possibly do. Be with us in this struggle to overcome the economic domination that we experience every day. So we got to look at this class stuff. We got to look at our ethnicity, try to get in touch with our own culture, be white allies, but at the same time understand that whiteness doesn't mean anything except as a strategy, and get in touch with your culture and understand it and live it and so forth. And use all of this in this kind of pot as you're doing social analysis, because you don't want to be doing strategies that are counterproductive, that aren't nailing the problem as it should be. So Thandeka suggests, and we'll end on this note, I guess, suggests that Unitarian Universalist churches could become like little base communities. In Latin America, these base communities, people would come together, they'd talk about the problems in the neighborhood, then they'd look at the Bible and see what the Bible has to say, and then they'd do their action. It's kind of this action, reflection, contemplation, action, back and forth. Look at social reality, what are the problems? Let's do theological analysis, what are our values, and then do our actions, making sure we don't violate our principles. So UU churches could become little base communities. So for those of us who are working outside of these killing zones, at least we're not aware of sacrifice zones in our neighborhood, in the suburbs or rural areas, I think the important thing is to become allies. You know, we need big coalitions, urban, suburban, in our community organizing work that I've talked about so much. These are suburban, urban, rural coalitions. We need these coalitions across race lines, ethnicity, across class lines, because that's where power is. If we have these coalitions, we have a chance to make change. Decisions get made at the state level and the national level. We need big coalitions to make change. So if, as most UU congregations are, I guess, in the suburban or rural areas, to become an ally with people who are not in those areas, and like Don Robinson's ministry in Northeast Washington and so forth, to make those kind of links. And also, for those urban struggling churches that are still in our movement, like Allegheny and others, for other churches to become allies, you know, and help provide resources that maybe that church doesn't have, that maybe some other church has in excess. We need to do more of that. It's all part of a collective vision, you know, not just look at my church, but what's going on at Allegheny. Anyone in Pittsburgh or anyone in Cleveland about Canton or Cleveland Heights, do you know what's going on there? Do you ever think about visiting and forming better relationships? Some of that's gone on. I think we can do it better.